This is Central Time. There's been a revolution in the world of American energy led by the process of hydraulic fracturing, better known as fracking. The process led to a boom in the production and use of natural gas in the United States, along with environmental controversy.
Wisconsin has been a part of that revolution with a boom in sand mines for use in fracking. And it's an issue in Congress this week, too. The House passed a bill that would loosen regulations on fracking, and the White House says those would be vetoed.
Our next guest tells the story of the rise of fracking and the people who made it a successful industry. Gregory Zuckerman is with us. He's a special writer for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is The Frackers, the outrageous inside story of the new billionaire wildcatters. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
So how much has fracking changed the American energy landscape?
It's changed the energy landscape, but it's frankly changed the country, and it's going to change other nations around the world. We're moving towards energy independence. Just a few years ago, we were worried about where we were going to get our natural gas and oil. And we now produce about 8 million barrels a day of oil. That's up from about 5 in 2005. We're going to hit 11 at some point in the next few years. We're relying on Middle East for just about 8% of our oil now, and that's dropping. And we're going to be exporting natural gas in a couple of years. It's just a dramatic change. It's helping the economy, helping a lot of small-town America, and it's causing lots of controversy.
When we look at the rise of the oil industry, there were some larger-than-life characters, intense competition, some scandals and shenanigans. Is the same thing true of fracking?
Well, that's what I write about in my book. So it's a book. I write about how we went from a country running out of energy to kind of having a surplus. And yeah, as you mentioned, there were shenanigans. There were interesting characters. There were people that you wouldn't have expected are the ones behind it. It's not Chevron and Exxon and the giants and the experts. It's a few people that believed in this country, didn't have much of a choice, didn't have offshore assets, and figured out how to hydraulically fracture or frack and drill horizontally for the first time in shale, which is a very compressed, challenging kind of rock, and they made it happen.
Why? I'm imagining the companies you just named, their executives are kicking themselves for not getting into this big money industry early on. Why didn't they?
You know, what's interesting to me, it's very much like the financial meltdown, believe it or not. The conventional wisdom back then was that housing wasn't going to collapse. And the conventional wisdom in the energy world was that this shale, this kind of rock, it looks a little bit like tombstone, couldn't really release a lot of oil and gas. We all knew, everyone knew, every geologist knew that there was a lot of oil and gas in shale. They called it source rock. It's the source for all the oil and gas that eventually, over millions of years, flows closer to the surface. But people figured it's too far down. It's about 14,000 feet below. In some places, it's too expensive to try to get this really hard rock to give up oil and gas. But a few people said, no, we're going to ignore what the Exxon of the world said. And Exxon was heading off to Africa and Asia, and they had lots of places to go. And a few people didn't have those options. And they were American wildcatters, and I write about them. And they figured out how to get this this shale to give up lots of oil and gas.
Who was the first wildcatter to make a go of it, to make it work?
So the first person was a guy named George Mitchell, and he ran a mid-sized Texas company, and they were running out of natural gas. They had to deliver about 10% of all the gas going to Chicago and some other places. And by the early 80s, he realized he was running out. His company was running out, and he told his guys, well, we're sitting on a layer of shale. Let's try to figure it out. And everyone said he's a little bit crazy, and even his own heir apparent told Mitchell's men not to work on this stuff. It's a waste of time. And Mitchell kept pushing them, and he was about 80 by the late 90s, and he was getting sick. He had cancer. His wife was he was even sicker, and he was close to bankruptcy at the time, personal bankruptcy, because the stock had collapsed. And finally, they had an aha moment, a breakthrough, a guy named Nick Steinsberger, who really history doesn't give enough credit to. He figured out how to right combination of water with some chemicals and some sand to release all this gas. And then people kind of built on that breakthrough afterwards.
And that turned the company around?
Turned the company around. They sold it for $2 billion. And at the time, people said, okay, so Mitchell and his guys, they figured out how to do it in Texas, but other shale around the country, there's no way people are going to be able to get gas, and let alone oil, for sure. They didn't take oil. And then a few other people that I write about said, no, let's go figure out how to do it elsewhere. There's a guy named Harold Hamm who grew up dirt poor. He was so poor that he had to work in the fields. His parents were sharecroppers in a little town in Oklahoma. And he couldn't even go to school each year until around Christmas time, because only then was it so cold that his parents couldn't pick cotton and watermelon. So Harold Hamm started off dirt poor, and he had a dream of finding oil, and people thought he was a little nuts, and he was a little bit of an odd guy. He never went to college and didn't take geology and wasn't an engineer, but he had his belief in America and belief that in his own ability to find oil, and he was a kind of old-school wildcatter, and he drove his guys into North Dakota, and one of his men said, hey, let's figure out the shale layer here and other kind of challenging layers. And today he's worth about $14 billion. He's going through a divorce, unfortunately, but his wife is going to walk away with more money than Oprah Winfrey. So it's a rags-to-riches kind of story.
And North Dakota, that's a home to a lot of the fracking, a lot of this energy boom. Why there? What is it about that place and the land and the people?
That's exactly right. So it's called the Bakken Formation, and it's an area that's always had booms and busts, and we always knew there was a lot of oil there and gas as well, but it didn't seem like the rock was going to be the kind that we could really get much out of. And it's very challenging. It's deep below the ground, as I say. It's very low, very narrow and long, these shale layers. But we always knew there was a lot of oil in there. It just didn't. Part of the reason why guys like Hamm and others headed up there is that oil and gas prices got kind of expensive around 2007, 2008. And this method, this hydraulic fracturing or fracking and horizontal drilling, is pretty expensive when you go all the way down 14,000 feet below sometimes to the shale region. So it got, but since oil and gas prices were so expensive, if you remember right before the financial crisis, it was worth it for these guys to experiment and to tweak it. And it's very much a story of innovation. And, you know, America gets criticized for not innovating anymore. I joke that really all we're really good at, or what we're better than the rest of the world, is rapping, making drones, apps, and fracking. But fracking is one thing we have an advantage versus the rest of the world in.
We're talking to Gregory Zuckerman about his new book, The Frackers. It's about the rise of fracking of natural gas and oil and the people and personalities behind this energy boom.
And you can join in. Do you have a question about fracking and its role in the economy? You can call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Thanks, Kristen. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at the latest developments on nuclear negotiations with Iran.
Now we continue our conversation about fracking and the booming business behind it with Gregory Zuckerman. His new book is The Frackers. We'll take your calls in just a few moments at 800-642-1234. Gregory, from a business perspective, a big success story. There's been a lot of criticism about the environmental impact of fracking, especially on water quality in nearby areas. What do you make of that argument?
So I spent a lot of time researching this and talked to all kinds of scientists and went out to various places, including Pennsylvania, which have been kind of controversial. And the way I come down on it in the book is that both sides really overstate their arguments. So the people that say fracking poisons, their three main concerns are, A, that the chemicals, and they're not chemicals we all want to ingest, the chemicals used in fracking are going to get into our water system from the places where we frack. And if you talk to sort of objective scientist types, they say it's really unlikely. The reason is we basically drill between 4,000 and 14,000 feet below the surface, and the aquifers are usually between 400 feet and 1,200 feet below the surface. And again, it's really unlikely that the chemicals somehow are going to magically make their way into the aquifers. The other concern is everyone's seen the movies, the pictures where you turn on the faucet and you light it on fire. And that's happened. A lot of places in the country, methane has gotten into the water system. And as a result, you can light things on fire. Unfortunately, it's hard to tell. It's really unlikely that this is due to fracking. There are three towns in this country called Burning Springs. In other words, they've always been able to light things on fire. American Indians did it. I talked to old timers and some of these little towns in Pennsylvania, and they said, Greg, when we were little, we would light it on fire and the faucets on fire in school and run for it. So that's always been the case. It just happens that in some places in this country, methane naturally gets into the water. And then the last is the earthquakes, and there have been some tremors, but there are ways to avoid that. Now, I also say that the producers, the energy companies, overstate their argument, too. They say, you know, drill baby, redrill, which is really inappropriate because they've had poorly sealed wells, blowouts, leaks, surface spills, all kinds of things that have damaged water, damaged, and they damage the air as well. About 1 in 10 of these wells has some cement issue that has to be fixed. So fracking can be done properly and safely, but that's not to say that it is being done properly and safely.
Is this an industry that's outrun regulation?
No, I don't think so. And they also care a lot more about the environment than you would think. I kind of went into this as a reporter thinking these are sort of cigar-chomping Houston executives kind of giggling their way to the bank and spilling left and right. And they're not like that. They're outdoors people usually. They're geologists. They like rock. They hunt. They fish. They have ranches. So they don't see themselves as being polluters. It's not to say they don't pollute. So I think they're aware of the backlash. They don't like the PR. And now big companies, we talked earlier about how the big companies didn't believe in this kind of drilling. Now they do. They're all racing back to America, the Exxons of the world. So they're doing things a little bit better. They're more conscious of these issues because they don't want the PR. Early on, it was sort of wildcatters, independent wildcatters, and they made a lot of mistakes.
We'll go to our phones now. We've got Alice with us in Sheboygan. Alice, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to call and talk a little bit about the effects it's having on Wisconsin with the sand. We have the sand mines here that the sand is going out for the fracking, and your guest brought up the water, and the water that we use for the high-capacity wells to get the sand out is really taking down our aquifers. We had a case in western Wisconsin where a farmer lost all his water due to a fracked sand mine near him, and our legislature passed new regulations so the farmer couldn't do anything. And as far as the people who are doing the fracking, the people who are making money may be hunting and fishing and enjoying nice places, but a lot of the people that I have met who've been out fracking, it's a dirty job. And the
towns for sure,
they're not necessarily happy to have a bunch of 20-some-year-olds who come in with a lot of money and act up.
Gotcha. Alice, thanks. Let's she said that a dirty job in a couple ways, and you wanted to respond to how dirty a job is it, Gregory?
Oh, yeah, the people in the field, they're in danger. The air quality is often bad. And it is a divisive thing. People, and I've traveled the country, in some communities, they love it. People, farmers can stay in their farms, and people are moving back to small towns who are, and a lot of the young people had been moving away. And, you know, I talked to a young man in Louisiana who makes over $100,000 a year and didn't go to college. So some people are really being helped. But if you don't own your own land, if you rent, let's say, in one of these small towns and real estate prices are going up, it hurts you. There are a lot of people that are unhappy with the crime she had suggested. And it's true, crime has increased as these cities sort of get bigger and they're busier and out-of-towners come in and workers. You know, these aren't bad people. A lot of these people have left homes elsewhere in the country. Instead of going on unemployment, they picked up and drove somewhere like North Dakota. But, yeah, they get into trouble sometimes. And it's a mixed story. It's a very gray. To me, it's a gray story. It's brought a lot of good, but it's also divided communities.
And she also brought up the water usage, mentioning our sand mines here in Wisconsin, but also the fracking process uses sand. It uses water. Is it enough water to make a difference in local aquifers and tap people out?
I'm not aware of that. You know more about that. I do know there's a lot of water used, about 5 million on average gallons per well, and that's a huge amount of fresh water that's used. So we as a nation, you know, have to have a discussion about whether it's worth our while. I mean, fracking takes a lot of water. So do things like golf courses, a huge amount of water. So, you know, we have to prioritize. If this is not what we want to prioritize and we want to, you know, shift elsewhere, that's fine. We need energy. We need natural gas, and we're not ready, unfortunately, we're not ready yet for solar and wind. I'd love for there to be, and we will eventually. But we're not quite there yet, unless we want to go nuclear. I'm a big fan of nuclear, but a lot of people aren't. We unfortunately have to depend on natural gas.
Take a call now from Derek in Round Lake, Illinois. Derek, hi.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Good program. As a writer and reporter myself, actually, I listen to your guest's opinions, and I think he lives in sort of a parallel universe. I just wanted to be aware that several European governments as well as American states have banned a variety of different forms of fracking, not only because of the water issue, aquifer issues, but also tectonic issues. Those things also cause earthquakes and damage. So I think you know, there's a really necessary national conversation that needs to be had specifically about benefits as well as the drawbacks of fracking. And I think it's, you know, his opinion, very positive opinion on this apparently, which doesn't tell the whole story, I think it's really troubling because American people should really be better informed than this.
Derek, thanks a lot for the call. Gregory?
You're exactly right. Other nations have banned fracking, but they're quite silly in their decision. It's a misguided decision because as a result, their air quality, their carbon dioxide emissions are going up. We're the only country in the world that's cut carbon dioxide emissions over the last few years by 12%. We're back to where we were in 1994. It's because we're shifting away from coal towards natural gas. Now, other countries are increasing their use of coal. European countries, unfortunately, England, and Germany's carbon dioxide emissions are going up. So Germany is a big believer in wind, and they've invested in the infrastructure, and I wish we would as well here. I wish we had the money to do that as well here. But as a result, they don't like nuclear. They've cut back after Fukushima nuclear, and as a result, their carbon dioxide emissions are going up. So the only way we can actually do anything, make any dent in terms of global warming, is if we can convince foreign countries like China to start fracking and to start reducing their use of coal and shifting to natural gas. That's what I would argue.
Gregory, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, great to be here.
That was Gregory Zuckerman with The Wall Street Journal. His new book is The Frackers.